Welcome to Worst Year Ever, a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
And welcome back to the worst year ever. Dang, we're still here.
Keeps being the worst year ever. Never stops.
It really does, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's just
why would we ever want to leave?
Why would we ever leave? How could we possibly leave?
It's true,
please,
you can't leave time.
It, let us know if you know how we could possibly leave, because we are pretty desperate at this point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
With that, we have a really great interview for you guys today with freelance journalist Eamon Thent. Did I do it right? Eamon Thent. Daniel, you got me. Who is currently covering the military coup in Myanmar. And we are very, very grateful that they took the time to speak with us because it's a pretty dire situation, and it was a really informative conversation. You guys got stuff?
It's about to happen.
It's about to happen.
You can't stop it. Like the year, nothing can be done to stop this from hitting your ears. It's inevitable.
You do
like
not
the changing of the tides.
Have an option to press pause or stop.
No,
buckle up, baby.
No. Whenever somebody pauses this podcast, we send out Cody with a brick to break their kneecaps.
Mm-hmm. It hasn't worked yet, but I still go. No. I still go and try.
No, he is not good at the job.
Real bad. My heart's not in it, but
no, it's not.
But don't make us fire Cody, not during a pandemic.
No, so hand over your knees to Cody or just keep listening to the podcast that's about to come.
So today we are joined by Eamon Thent, Burmese American Pulitzer Prize winning freelance journalist currently covering the military coup that started on February 1st in Myanmar. And up top, I just want to acknowledge this is an incredibly dangerous time to be a journalist covering this. And we just really want to thank you for taking the time and check in to see how you're doing, because this is a lot that you've been going through right now.
Yeah, no, thank you for covering the story. I know we got a lot of attention in the first month or so of the coup. And you know, now that things have kind of, I guess, plateaued in terms of action, there's a lot less coverage on the issue. And so it's really great to see platforms like this that are interested in making sure that this stays in the national conversation, especially in countries like the US, where, you know, a big difference can be made.
Yeah.
Depending on policy decisions.
Yeah.
Would you be able to give us kind of an overview of how things have gone, right? Like, here's how it started. Here's when the violence escalated. Here's where we are now, just to kind of start us off.
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, this coup started on February 1st. And you know, I say it started because to me, this coup is something that hasn't been successful yet. Mm-hmm. The military arrested a number of elected leaders on the day that the new government was supposed to form. And, you know, they attempted to essentially take over all government functions and to be in charge of the country. But, you know, given that there's been mass protests throughout the streets every single day, essentially since the beginning of February, there is a civil disobedience movement that has essentially stopped the banking system in the country. And, you know, doctors, teachers, anyone who has been working with the government or through the government as an employee have largely stopped working. You know, they haven't been able to be the government. They haven't been able to exert control except through the end of a gun and sort of through terror. So, you know, they arrested over 150 elected politicians on that first day, essentially preventing the new government from forming. And began arresting activists, union leaders, people who would pose a threat, who could bring the public together in any sort of organized way. And yet, you know, you had millions of people who have been out in the streets protesting, even as the military began to kill people, essentially in cold blood. There's been over 700 people who are now confirmed to have been killed by the military or police since the beginning of the coup by local rights groups. Thousands of people have been jailed. A number of them have been released, but there are hundreds who have essentially just been disappeared. You know, their families don't know where they are, but the military and the police also will not admit that they have been taken. And so those people are the ones people are the most worried about, because those are the sorts of people who come back as mutilated bodies, essentially. Yeah. You know, you have politicians in hiding, activists in hiding, journalists who have either left the country or are in hiding. And, you know, on the other side of the resistance to the coup, you know, very early on, there was a leaderless mass movement that sprung up, largely led by civil servants, such as doctors and teachers, but also, you know, people you would normally not think of as leaders in society, like railway workers and garment industry workers, people who are heavily unionized and really organized and who, you know, have been fighting for their rights and freedoms for a long time. You know, even as the movement right now is very focused on returning to a civilian government and restoring people who rightfully won the 2020 election. You know, people do also really understand that in the last 10 years of largely civilian quasi-democratic rule, that a lot of people, especially the poor, especially ethnic and religious minorities, were not treated as full citizens of the country who had equal rights. And now we've moved into a phase where there's essentially two opposing groups claiming to be the government of Myanmar. There is the National Unity Government and all of their allies. There's a lot of acronyms. I'm not going to go into that right now.
Yeah.
But they're called the NUG. We like to call ourselves Nuggets.
Okay.
Of the civilian government.
I like it.
And not all of them are were elected. Many of them were appointed. Many of them were early protest leaders who, you know, are in their late 20s, 30s, people who would never have made it into government in the previous times. And they are now, you know, trying to get international recognition.
And this is the National Unity Government.
Yeah, yeah. So now they're trying to set up essentially a functional government, an alternative system for people to answer to and work with who are not the military. And so right now, the power struggle is really between these two groups, one of whom is made up of elected officials as well as leaders who have emerged through the anti-coup movement, and then the military, which, you know, not only are they a very oppressive and brutal institution, there's also quite a number of people who are part of the military who were essentially recruited as child soldiers. Rights groups estimate that anywhere between 30 and 60% of recruits were forced into the military.
Wow.
And when it comes to actual, like, territorial control within these two groups, how does that kind of break down? Like, is it a situation where you've got, like, regime-controlled territory and not, or is it just kind of much more muddled and mixed?
So it's very complicated in Myanmar. So Myanmar's essentially been in a civil war for 60, almost 70 years now. Between the largely Bama ethnic majority group controlled military and a number of political organizations that often have armed wings in minority areas or minority majority areas, which are tend to be around the borders of the country. So there are currently what are being called free zones, which is areas being controlled by ethnic armed organizations. These are in allyship with the National Unity Government, but they're not under the control of the National Unity Government. And the majority of ethnic armed organizations in Myanmar, and there's dozens, have essentially declared that they will protect protesters regardless of you know, their political affiliation. It's more about protecting civilians as opposed to aligning themselves with the new government.
It's very smart.
Yeah.
Welcome to the worst year ever.
Little bit about you've mentioned it's pseudo democracy and it's been a relatively new institution there, and so can we talk a little bit about that power struggle, that power share that led us to this, because I think we also need to talk about Aung San Suu Kyi, of course, and it's complicated. It's a complicated situation you've got going on over there.
Yeah, because I don't have a particularly deep base of knowledge here, but I remember hearing earlier a lot of allegations that she was kind of being used as a puppet by the military for a lot mm-hmm. of the stuff that was happening with the Rohingya.
And so that's very unclear as we are over here trying to unpack everything that's happening there, because of course she was sold to us as a democratic leader that we should get behind and an inspiration. And then very quickly it turned out that this huge humanitarian crisis was happening under her watch. Anyway, you're the expert.
Well, I think what happened with Aung San Suu Kyi and the sort of like very divided view of her, because she's still seen as this, for a lot of people in Myanmar, mm-hmm. not everyone, seen as this, you know, perfect icon and faultless leader in Myanmar. Whereas in the West, because she was sold as this perfect icon, right? Like any mistake or like genuine awful thing she did, and she did awful things, was seen as like, oh, we were lied to, we were tricked. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, she's a complicated person with imperfect politics. Mm-hmm. She's always been extremely Buddhist, quite nationalist. It makes sense, you know, that considering her father fought against colonialism, right? Mm-hmm. Colonialism breeds a lot of nationalism into people. And so she's always been someone who has been quite open about the fact that she thinks Myanmar is first and foremost a Buddhist Burma nation, where everyone else is kind of guests who should behave appropriately. And the country is, you know, quite majority Buddhist and Burma. So, you know, I think what has been happening with the sort of transition into democracy for Myanmar is we had colonialism, and then that really created the country as we know it today. You know, it drew the borders of the country and brought together a bunch of various kingdoms and like essentially hill tribes and people who had various forms of government and put them all and smashed them into one nation of mm-hmm. people who never existed as a political entity together before. And basically immediately after independence, people began declaring internal independence from mm-hmm. the new country that had been formed. And then through a series of coups and sort of military takeovers, the country essentially became a totalitarian state, really second only to North Korea for decades. And then in 2010, the country began to transition into more of a democratic form. So we had elections where everyone was allowed to run, essentially, who wasn't in jail. And there were thousands of people in jail as political prisoners. But, you know, if you weren't in jail, you were allowed to run. And many people boycotted it because the constitution wasn't great. It guaranteed the military 25 seats to military officials, and then also allowed military parties and military affiliated parties to run. And so in 2010, we began to have a more democratic country and government, but it was still essentially run by the military, but with reform-minded generals. And so we began to see more press freedom. We saw censorship end, or official censorship, pre-publication censorship end. We saw the release of quite a number of political prisoners. We saw liberalization of the economy and the allowance of essentially the state monopolies to end and allow other sorts of businesses to begin to establish themselves. And then in 2015, all of these parties that had boycotted the 2010 election decided, you know, the constitution isn't perfect. There's a lot we need to change, but we can't do that completely from the outside. So we're going to run. And after that election, we ended up with a government where the military controlled basically every gun in the country. They controlled the armed forces, the police, and the border guard, as well as a lot of the sort of day-to-day administration. Think your local district office that would be controlled by the military, but the majority of the rest of the government was controlled by elected civilians. In this case, it ended up being Aung San Suu Kyi's party. And so, yeah, there was this very uneasy power sharing. And when the Rohingya crisis happened, I think the people of Myanmar really felt that they were being unfairly blamed for something that the military did. Mm-hmm. And it caused this like intense defensiveness mm-hmm. that didn't allow them to have the conversation of, okay, well, why are we not fighting for the Rohingya? You know, why are we okay with this group being victimized? Now, what does it mean that some group can be victimized in the country? What does this mean on a more systematic institutional level, beyond the sort of like basic decency of like no one deserves to be subject to genocide? But yeah, I think that's in a nutshell kind of what was happening here.
Yeah. That sounds like there's like a rapid expansion in a short period of time for you guys. Culturally, economically, and everything when things started to shift. And it feels like this crux in time probably feels very different approaching this protest movement, approaching organizing. I would just love to have a comparison between this time and in the past when there has been a lot of large organized movements against the military.
Yeah, so there's been a few mass uprisings. This is also the third coup for Myanmar.
Yeah.
And you know, I think what has made this time really different is there's internal factors. So the main one would be that now people are fighting to keep something. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Whereas so after the first coup, you essentially went from, British colonial masters to like a very chaotic quasi military government into, you know, fairly still a military government, but it wasn't that bad in the 60s. And mm-hmm. so you know, it wasn't that jarring of a transition. But by the time the 1988 elections happened and the uprising happened, people had been under dictatorship for decades, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's much more difficult for people to imagine something that they were trying to build as opposed to just saying, we don't like what's currently happening. And with the protest movement now, what we're really seeing is people saying, you know, what we had was imperfect, but we need to get back there so we can go somewhere even better. And I think that's the really big difference and the key difference we're seeing internally. And then externally, I think, you know, the international response has not been ideal, but it's the international community has also learned from past mistakes. They haven't imposed the sort of blanket sanctions that we saw in the past that really didn't harm the military, right? There's right now quite a lot of focus on targeting specific organizations and individuals. And, you know, if we could see more unity on that, if we could see countries stop selling arms to Myanmar, if we could see sort of the release of Myanmar state assets to the new civilian government, you know, these are all things that could really make a difference in the long run of this movement.
Yeah, you had mentioned that to me separately and wanted to bring that up. So this feels like a great time, you know, specifically in terms of the U.S. sanctions.
So, you know, in the very first few days of the coup, the U.S., I think Department of Treasury, I guess, essentially froze all Myanmar assets that were in the U.S. Under U.S. control. Mm-hmm. And that amounts about $1 billion. Because, you know, even though there wasn't sort of a set policy yet from the Biden administration, you know, they want to make sure that they essentially tried to withdraw $1 billion. And so now that money is frozen, but now that we do have a civilian government made up of elected officials who have a mandate from the people, who have been able to get agreements and cooperation from ethnic armed organizations, they're going to start needing money. You know, civil servants have been striking for almost 3 months. These are not people who are well paid. Most of them live in government housing, and many of them have either been terminated from their jobs or have been forced out of their housing. And so the unity government is now trying to pay all of these civil servants. They're trying to ensure that there aren't food shortages in Myanmar. People are already starting to suffer from that. And really to make sure that people can continue to oppose the military without essentially starving themselves.
Yeah. without feeling like they have the choice to die or comply.
Oh yeah, and that's one of these one of the main problems we get to when it comes to when the U.S. does take action about human rights abuses. Often our go-to is some form of sanctions, and they generally just wind up hurting the people who live in that country rather than the people who are committing whatever human rights abuse inspired the action. And I think it's good to like freeze assets that makes sense. And I've heard suggestions of like, you know, releasing them to the I think we would consider the legitimate government. But I don't know, like what else can be done? Like, because it seems, and maybe I have an accurate view of this because of my distance, but it seems like the deck is stacked pretty heavily in the military's favor at the moment. And I don't like what is it you think would need to happen in order to change the situation in a positive way?
Yeah, so I think you're right in that the deck is heavily stacked in the military's favor, but
they got the guns.
Yeah, the guns. Well, they have like bombs.
I actually have a whole other question about the military. We'll get to, but they have a whole separate ecosystem almost over there, like their own. But we'll get to that.
But yeah, you know, I think a sign of hope and a place to look if you want some optimism is just the fact that despite them having, you know, fighter jets and guns and just so much information about people, because, you know, as an authoritarian country, or just collects lots and lots of data about the people who live there, they've not been able to win. You know, they can't get the banks to open. They can't get doctors to go back to work. They recently, like yesterday, called in the parents of civil servants to get them to pressure their children.
Oh my God.
Like
they got called to the principal's office.
They told on the parents of the protesters. You know, like they are really struggling. Even as they're, you know, killing people and terrorizing people, like people are really refusing to be cowed, essentially. Sorry, I've forgotten the question.
No, that's how it goes here.
Yeah, I'm just kind of wondering. Yeah, I think the question we're trying to answer is like, what do you think? How could you see things ending in a positive direction? Like, what would have to happen? And I guess part of why I'm asking that question is I'm trying to wonder what the international community can do outside of, you know, freezing arms sales to the military would be one thing. Although I don't know how likely that is given the geopolitical situation. And kind of, you know, releasing that money to the legitimate government is another option. But like, is there anything else? What do you think would need to happen for things to resolve in a more positive direction? Like, what's it going to take? If that's that may be a question without a clear answer at the moment.
Yeah. So I think there's a few things that can be done by various actors. I think if we're talking about the US side, you know, as we were saying earlier, using those funds and pressuring other countries, allied nations, to recognize the national unity government as the legitimate government of Myanmar and to treat them as such, right? So if ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, is going to have a meeting about Myanmar, like they should be invited. They should be the first invite. If, you know, countries like Singapore and Japan and South Korea, which are heavily invested in Myanmar, they're some of the biggest investors in Myanmar, are going to continue to, you know, invest money, whether that's in development or in, you know, sort of private business, they need to ensure that they're working with the civilian government and not the military. And these are things that kind of can happen from the US end, which is obviously a bit more difficult in that this is one of the very few struggles in the world where US imperialism is not implicated really in any way. And, you know, the Myanmar military does not care what the West thinks of it. It does not care about the West's money. They've, you know, survived for decades and decades without it. And yeah, like the sanctions can often really harm sort of people who, like normal everyday people. I think something that the US has done quite well in this case is to make it very clear that no military intervention is coming. I know that's something that many people on the ground have been hoping for, because they see things like what's been happening in, you know, Middle Eastern countries and say, like, mm-hmm. well, it's possible there. Why isn't it possible here? And the U.S. being very clear in that the language where they talk about it, and like sanctioning very specific industries. So mining and logging and these sort of like, you know, industries that are already extremely exploitative to the people who work in it, mm-hmm. and then pretty much only like mess up the earth and benefit those at the very top. So like jade. Yeah. And then I think on the sort of broader international level, yeah, just like refusing to engage with the military besides trying to get them to hand over power, as opposed to what ASEAN did, which was really just like a weird welcome party to the military leader, where they told him like everyone needs to stop the violence, and really doing this like very wishy-washy sort of language, which was then used by the military in Myanmar in sort of these now like military-run propaganda outlets as like, you know, the world has welcomed this new government as a stabilizing force in the region.
I know I mentioned this in passing a minute ago, but I would like to hear a little bit. Gosh, I've got so many things I want to hear about, but from what I understand, yes, the military is almost separate from everybody else, the average citizen. You know, they have their own schools and own hospitals, you know, banks. Are those things being affected by the strike? And I'm also just, I'm just curious about it because I guess that has to play a huge part in how the military can be so desensitized to orders of killing citizens. I mean, children, babies, there's just, we don't need to go into all the horrifying specifics, but this is a horrifying story that's happening right now. And I'm just trying to wrap my mind around it all, you know?
Yeah, it's been very difficult to get into the psychology of people who are in the security forces, whether that is military or police. We're definitely seeing a lot more police defections. And I think it goes to what you were saying of, you know, most police officers are not sort of born and raised into this very separate sort of internal society, right? These are usually just like people who, for whom this is like one of the few decent paying jobs with the potential for a pension in the future. And so you have a lot of those people kind of running away into India, into the free zones, into Thailand and such. But yeah, it's been very, very difficult to understand the mindsets of the soldiers and really what they're being told. So there was a lot of rumors in Myanmar, and based on the testimony of recently defected soldiers, it seems very likely that the internet, the like mobile data internet cuts, were more targeted towards keeping soldiers from knowing what was happening than from the civilian organizing themselves. I mean, you know, they obviously also don't want the civilian population organizing themselves, but you know, defected soldiers are telling us they're not allowed to read non-military papers. They're not allowed to watch news. Wow. It's the military-run channels. They can't listen to other types of radio. And, you know, many of them were taken when they were 12, 13. They were raised in an environment where, like, brutality meant not only did you survive and avoid violence yourself, but you could be, you know, greatly rewarded. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're in this, like, extremely homosocial environment where not only are you being taught to be brutal, you're being told that that is how you're protecting the country and defending Buddhism and defending mm-hmm. this idea of what it means to be Myanmar. And, you know, I think in part why we're seeing this sort of violence right now is because many of these soldiers feel betrayed. You know, they've been at war for decades. They've been out in the forest getting malaria. And now you have all these ungrateful civilians who like don't understand their struggles, who are forcing them to essentially like, you know, work all day, every day, often with very little food. We see soldiers stealing food all the time. Like we see them stealing snacks, Like, they're hungry. They're very poorly paid at the sort of infantry level. And they're overworked. And, like, that's part of the goal. Like, they're trying to make these usually young boys, like, much more aggressive than they would otherwise be, and see the people as their enemy. Yeah.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
You talked a lot about, you know, the civil disobedience, the protest movement, and I'm curious what the mood on the ground is like. I guess this kind of goes along with Robert's line of questioning. Do people feel galvanized by the fact that you have been doing this protest movement in such a sustained fashion? I mean, I find it very inspiring. I mean, it sounds overwhelming and like an uphill battle, but, you know, a general strike is something that is talked about a lot and very rarely executed. And there has to be some sort of power in that. So I'm curious what the mood is. But also, conversely, people are being slaughtered. So, you know, it's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of terror that's on the ground. Yeah, I mean, obviously engineered to be so. Like, there have been cases where the police would come and try to arrest a politician or, you know, a member of a political party, and he won't be home because, you know, he's understands the situation and is in hiding, and they will take his children. Like, the youngest person who's been arrested is 2, and they were arrested because they couldn't find their father. And so there is a lot of that happening, but at the same time, there's also just this, like, really defiant joy that's been very intentionally cultivated. You know, like, you look at protests, and, like, all the protests are themed, right? Like, there are people trying to have fun, trying to be creative. There was a condom protest where they blew up condoms and stuck pictures of people who shouldn't have been born in them.
That's really good.
That's a good idea. Yeah.
When they started using sound grenades in the cities, you know, after the kind of noise would end, people would yell out Happy New Year. When they were using water cannons, people started playing Burmese New Year's music, because our New Year's is a water festival, and people would just start dancing in the water cannon. Some people would fall over because, you know, it's a water cannon. But, you know, just people really trying to make sure that there's joy to be had, and that this isn't sort of something, like, awful and miserable that we all have to kind of just, like, hunker down and get through.
That you're fighting for something.
Joy is incredibly important when you're trying to get people to endure violence for an extended period of time. That makes total sense.
We're also seeing a lot of sort of community support networks propping up. Like, essentially, people are doing anarchy. Although they're not barely calling it that. So, like, if you go to markets, there's quite a number of stalls now that say, take if you need it, give if you, like, don't. And so, like,
it's really beautiful.
There's no one at the stalls. Like, you can just go and, like, take all the food if you wanted to. But you see just, like, a pile of cash, and then some people just, you know, they can't pay, they can't afford it. You know, people are, like, everyone is involved. There's, like, marketing agencies that are paying for lawyers' fees for journalists. There are bankers who are secretly funding, you know, transportation for protesters. Like, it's really this huge cross-section of Myanmar society. And, you know, it's one of the struggles where, like, the military, like, legitimately has, like, no popular base, right? Like, it's not like a Thailand situation where there are legitimately people who are on both sides and, you know, are in sort of contention with one another.
I had something else I wanted to ask, and now it's out of my head.
I mean, I'm curious, do you see within kind of the tactics used by the protest movement, what do you see as, like, the main influences from overseas on kind of how people have organized and carried things out?
Yeah, so you see a lot of influences from Hong Kong and Thailand. You know, Myanmar is now officially part of the Milk Tea Alliance. We have a Twitter icon that combines all three of these countries. And, you know, a lot of the sort of protest safety tactics and digital security, especially tactics, were really brought wholesale from Thailand and Hong Kong to the point where activists in those countries were translating their resources into Burmese and disseminating them through their networks in Myanmar. You saw influences from the Black Lives Matter movement, although I would say that it was a very sort of shallow sort of engagement with Black Lives Matter. It was very confusing, but
sure. Makes sense. Yeah.
Just sort of like a lot of international memeing of memes. It's mostly the conversation's mostly happening with other Asian countries mm-hmm. that are facing authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious what the end goal would be, you know, for the resistance. Would this be to reinstate Aung San Suu Kyi, or, you know, is that the goal here?
So the goal has been changing. If you sort of were listening to protest chants and looking at signs in the earlier days of the protests, it was almost entirely focused on freeing Aung San Suu Kyi and getting democracy back, by which they mean like just, you know, like control Z the coup, just let the government form and like we'll just kind of forget about everything.
Yeah.
But now, you know, the civilian government has abolished the 2008 constitution.
Oh, really?
So they formed committees to create a new constitution in consultation with stakeholders from across sectors of society. For some reason, the new government has a prime minister, a president, and a state councilor. It's very confusing. I don't understand why.
Okay.
But Aung San Suu Kyi has maintained...
Well, an early draft of the United States Constitution, I do believe, had us having three presidents. So there's that.
Should have stuck with that. Should have stuck with that.
Yeah, we have two vice presidents. But Aung San Suu Kyi has been reappointed as state councilor. So... Okay. You know, there's quite a number of people who would like to continue to see her in that position. And I think it's also really important to remember, especially for those of us who are very critical of the level of democracy that is in Myanmar, as well as Aung San Suu Kyi and her party, that they did win the election by huge margins. Like they won 80% of the vote.
She's extremely popular.
Right. Like I can be as critical of her as I want, but she is the legitimate leader that the people chose.
Is she still on house arrest or is she, and like, what are the charges? What is the case against her that they're trying to make?
So she's still under house arrest as far as I know. Her trial is ongoing, but it has been postponed because she also doesn't have internet connection. And we're still dealing with COVID.
That was going to be my next question. Yeah.
So she's theoretically under house arrest. Her lawyers who have been able to see her occasionally say that she looks to be in good health. They're not allowed to really talk about anything that isn't the many cases that are against her. So there's a number of charges that have been levied against her. I think currently there are four. She was first arrested because she had illegally imported walkie-talkies into the country.
Okay.
This was done because supposedly there was election fraud, but they got her for...
Your election fraud via walkie-talkie.
Yeah, so the walkie-talkies in question were in use by her security detail, which are appointed by the military.
Okay. So
that's an interesting charge. The second charge she was levied with was... violating COVID restrictions by essentially creating situations in which people would gather, which is kind of true. Like anytime she goes in public.
Like a campaign?
No, it's just like if she goes outside, people gather. Like people love her. Like people love her. She had like, you know, she would like go to her home district and be like, I'm running again. And like thousands of people would just show up. Which like, you know, she shouldn't have done. But, you know. Everyone was also doing it. Like, you could arrest everyone for that.
I mean, around the world, politicians are going out and people are gathering. So, okay. But anyway.
Yeah, the third charge is the most serious charge. She has been charged under the Official Secrets Act. And she's essentially being accused of having information that could be helpful to enemies of Myanmar, which, as the head of government, one would have.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to be president without getting some of that.
Yeah. Well, she's above the president, actually. She's the highest official in the government. And then the fourth charge, I think, is another COVID-related charge.
So very clearly, it starts with the walkie-talkie, and then they're just, like, searching for other reasons to keep her.
We haven't gotten to the election fraud yet. Like, everyone's wondering when that will happen. Mm. So that was the justification for the coup.
Yeah, we're still waiting for proof on our election fraud, too.
Yeah. It was, like, what, 40 court cases?
Yeah. And you mentioned COVID, which is, of course, still a thing. And I know very little. I know nothing. I know nothing about the COVID situation over there. And what is it?
Yeah. So Myanmar was doing okay. Not economically. Like, COVID devastated the country.
Yeah.
The government weren't willing to have very harsh lockdowns. Or they weren't willing to enforce their lockdown. On paper, Myanmar had one of the strictest lockdowns in the world. Mm. But if you just kind of didn't care, you could just do whatever you want. Like, people were clubbing, and, you know, like, no one, like, many people didn't care. But for the most part, we were testing about pretty high, like 20,000 tests were being done every day. Mm-hmm. And the positivity rate was well under 5% for a good chunk of that time. And we were getting vaccines. You know, we had, I think the AstraZeneca vaccine, like, just a decent amount of promise from India. On paper, we're currently one of the most vaccinated countries by percentage in Southeast Asia, over a million people. Southeast Asia is doing really poorly, so it's not a good comparison. But supposedly over a million people have now been vaccinated. It's unclear who those people are, since no one's going to, like, doctors aren't working. At government facilities. And, you know, it's hard to imagine, like, random civilians just rolling up to a military hospital being like, yo, I want a vaccine.
And I bet it's hard to trust that data.
Yeah, it's very difficult to trust the data. And, you know, testing is essentially non-existent now. There's about 1,000 tests being done every day. And the majority of those are people trying to leave the country due to airline requirements and whatever. And a pretty high percentage of those people are testing positive.
Yeah.
Right? Like, these are people who, they're usually foreigners, so they're not going out to protest because, like, they would get extra. Yeah, it would just feel awful for them to be protesting. Like, it's illegal. I mean, I guess it's all illegal, but, you know, it's like, if you're hyper visible, you maybe don't want to do illegal.
Yeah.
And they're usually, like, wealthy enough to be able to fly out during this time because flights are really expensive right now. So, like, in a population of people who are probably just sitting at home and, like, don't have to go in anywhere to work anyway, the fact that they're testing positive, I think, means that it's quite likely the pandemic is really just raging. But, you know, we don't have data. We don't know.
And you've got a lot of things going on to keep track of. I mean,
yeah.
Well, and also here, Black Lives Matter. That's a good reason for people to come outside and to protest, you know, and you guys have. Yeah.
Well, and I think in the U.S. situation, like, hospitals still existed, you know, like, I mean, there was a lot of concern about Black Lives Matter, like, potentially sparking, like, being super spreader events.
Right. Like, which they weren't.
Hospitals. Yeah, they weren't. But, you know, like, even if they became that, it might have been handleable. Whereas here, like, the health infrastructure is gone, essentially. Wow. Like, people who have, like, you know, fairly routine things like diabetes are really struggling right now.
I'm just kind of curious, as somebody who's paying such close attention to this and doing all this reporting, if there's if there are outlets that you think are particularly good about this or particularly bad. You know, there's especially cases like this perspectives can seep into reporting. And I didn't know if there was any anything on that.
Yeah, like what are the best outlets to follow?
Yeah, so if anyone has any extra money they want to throw at this, Myanmar Now and Frontier Myanmar are really great local news organizations. They publish in both Burmese and English. You know, I mean, the news industry has no money. And like right now, not only are they dealing with reporting under these very strenuous circumstances, many of them are trying to flee or like hide out. And also, the police keep smashing our equipment, so people need to get new laptops. Yeah, so Myanmar Now and Frontier Myanmar, really great, award-winning organizations, locally run, multilingual. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of organizations are doing a pretty decent job, especially if they've been operating in Asia or in country for a long time. Like I wrote an article kind of blasting CNN for their little parachute journalism trip, but CNN Asia has actually done a really good job covering Myanmar. You know, like it really depends.
And then I guess, you know, we've talked about things the US could theoretically do, the example they could set, but as individuals, do you have any organizations that we could know of that we could donate to that would go, you know, directly to the right places?
Yeah. So there's a number of essentially GoFundMes. You just pressure GoFundMe to release the funds. GoFundMe, I mean, they're trying to do their due diligence. There's like a billion or like, you know, just hundreds of millions. Like they were not meant to fundraise for governments. But, you know,
in these unprecedented times,
pressure GoFundMe to like move a little faster in their due diligence work. You can donate to those.
We'll definitely link to all of those resources so that people can do something here. And man, thank you so much,
thank you for coming here.
This was really informative and terrifying, but also inspiring. Definitely going to be following this really closely. And if you ever want to come back, please just let us know.
Yeah, no, thank you for covering the story.
And let our listeners know where they can find you online.
I'm mostly just on Twitter since February 1st. I've not really been that online a person. Yeah. But you can find me at the_AmenThen. So just the underscore my full name.
We'll definitely have you linked as well. Yeah, thank you. Thank you again. And stay safe.
Everything's so dumb. Everything's so dumb, and it's
going to
get dumber.
Great. I tried.
Yes.
Daniel?
Lovely.
Worst Year Ever is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.